From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, the president says the U.S. withdrawal from Syria is about being realistic.
Let someone else fight over this long, bloodstained sand.
We'll try to sort out what's going on. Also today, with small colleges closing across New England, how should families think about choosing a school?
Students are choosing college for a whole host of reasons, but very few of which typically factor in these financial sustainability or questions or you know, will the school be around in a few years?
We'll take your questions and calls. And Andrew Ray, the creator of popular YouTube channel Binging with Babish.
I am a filmmaker, wannabe chef, and like you, I've always wondered, what does the food in film and television actually taste like? I'm here to answer some of those questions today.
That's all next on WBUR's Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Let someone else fight over this long, blood-stained sand. That's President Trump talking about the U.S. withdrawal from northern Syria yesterday as he announced a permanent ceasefire agreement with Turkey. The deal concerns Syria, Turkey, Russia, Iran, and Kurdish groups around the region. It's all high stakes and really confusing. So here to help us break it all down is Stephen Kinzer. He's a senior fellow in international and public affairs at Brown University's Watson Institute of International and Public Affairs. Stephen, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Always good to be here.
So we really are trying to kind of do an explainer here. So first, maybe a simple question. Could you start by explaining who are the Kurds and why are we talking about them as separate from the countries in the region?
The Kurds are descendants of a group of ancient mountain tribes. The first reference we have to them goes all the way back 2,500 years when the Greek historian Xenophon found some of these tribes, and he wrote two things about them. He said they live in the mountains, they're fierce, and they do not obey the king. So that's actually still a pretty good description. Kurds now number well into the tens of millions, and they're spread out because of the vicissitudes of modern geography over a region that includes eastern Turkey, Syria, Iran, Iraq. And it wasn't until the 19th century, with the growth of ethnic nationalism, that these different tribes began to think of themselves all as Kurds or a Kurdish nation. But they certainly have developed that consciousness now and have become an important factor, even though they've never had their own nation state.
So a virtual nation made up of a diaspora, basically.
Yes, although a diaspora suggests to me people that have come from somewhere else. By the time the Turks, for example, arrived in what's now Turkey, the Kurds had been there for well over 1,000 years.
Okay, so how did the U.S. and Kurdish groups end up on the same side fighting ISIS in Syria?
When the United States decided that it wanted to get involved in the Syria civil war, we did something similar to what we did when we decided to invade Afghanistan. That is, not wanting to send our own troops into battle, we looked for some partner force or mercenary force, if you will. Most of the forces that we found were fanatic jihadists who hated the secular Assad government. And one of the worst outcomes of this war is that we have fed a lot of weapons and money into al-Qaeda and ISIS-related groups. But we also found another ally, which was the Kurds. So they have often been for rent to Americans and their interest in the United States. They've traditionally been pro-American. They are known as good fighters. And they, unlike our other allies in Syria, are secularists themselves. So they participated quite vigorously in a number of American campaigns in Syria, including the battle to take Raqqa. Why did they do that? Not only were they paid and sponsored by the U.S. government, but we offered them something extra without saying it explicitly. The Kurds in northern Syria dreamed of establishing their own little statelet or mini country right along the Turkish border there. This was probably never realistic. The population is far too small. It has no air force. It was never going to be able to establish itself as a real state. But it could remain viable as long as the United States was there.
Okay.
So the effective deal was, we'll fight for you if you preserve us here in our little statelet and don't leave, because without you, we can't survive.
Okay, now I do want to move on, but I need to go back, and because I imagine some of our listeners went, I'm sorry, what? Because did you say a minute ago that the U.S. wound up funneling arms and support to Al-Qaeda and ISIS?
We did. Actually, our main cat's paws, our main supporters in Syria were groups that were jihadist. And the reason for this is very logical. We were trying to depose the secular government of Assad. And the people who hated Assad the most, not only in Syria, but people coming from all over the world, were Islamic extremists. They didn't want a secular regime in Syria. So when we were looking for partners to fight against Assad, we put aside the fact that these people were actually connected to Al-Qaeda and other jihadist groups and thought, just like the German politicians thought in the 1930s, we'll help these people overthrow Assad, and then once they get in, we'll control them.
All right. So given that background, move on to your reaction to the president's announcement yesterday of a permanent ceasefire agreement. What's your reaction?
The way this was done was obviously quite poorly planned and left terrible bad feelings, as well it should have. But for the Kurds, there was a logical plan B. Once the Americans were gone, their only logical ally left was Assad, the government, because those are the two principal anti-jihadist, the two principal secular forces in Syria. So the Kurds seek protection now from the Assad government, which, at the behest of the United States, they have been fighting up until now.
But is that, in your mind, a bad thing or a good thing?
I think it's a good thing. I think
Why?
It's the best way out for the Kurds. Right now, with the Americans out, the only hope for the Kurds is to get some protection against an unbridled Turkish onslaught. Turkey's on the border. Turkey considers the Kurds enemies, and it was already starting to bomb them. As a result of this agreement, Kurds will move back from the border, and Turkey will stop its war against them.
It's a little counterintuitive, because the Kurds were fighting against the regime. That's why we partnered with them. So why is there any reason to believe they would be protected by that regime now?
This is, of course, something that the Americans are warning the Kurds about even now. Don't ask for protection under Assad. But for the Kurds, it's the only other place to go.
What about Russia?
Russia will be a partner of Assad. So the Russians are actually some kind of a guarantor for the Kurds that they won't be repressed or crushed by Assad. However, if you spin this out in the future, the Kurds, now having been more or less rescued by the Russians in their deal with Assad and the Turks, could in the future become cat's paws for the Russians. The Russians could then be telling them, you owe us. And whenever Russia wants to stage some provocation against Turkey, they now have the Kurds on their side.
Okay, there's so much more to get into here. I'm torn between going back and picking up Turkey or staying with Russia for a minute. Let's stay with Russia for a minute. Because one perception of this situation, now that Erdogan and Turkey have gone in and the U.S. has pulled out and Erdogan has made his own deal with Russia, is that what the United States essentially did was cede United States interests to Russia to favor Russian interests, whether intentionally or not. What do you say to that?
There's some truth to that, but it's not a bad thing. Actually, what the ultimate shape of the Syrian government turns out to be is not a major strategic interest to the United States.
Then why were we there?
We never should have been. We were always there illegally. There was never a resolution of the U.S. Congress or any international body like the United Nations allowing us to be there. The United States has been trying to overthrow the Assad family government in Syria intermittently for 50 years. And this is because Syria has never embraced the American project in the Middle East. They've always been in the resistance front. When the so-called Arab Spring broke out, we thought this is our chance now
Egypt,
to get rid of Assad.
I just want to explain what the Arab Spring is.
When demonstrations started propping up across the Arab world, we presumed that this would also mean it's a chance for us to finish our agenda in Syria. And therefore, we partnered with people who normally we would have considered enemies, because we thought it was a way to destroy the Assad regime, which has been a thorn in our side unnecessarily, from our perspective, for many years.
Okay, last question in the history lesson side, and then we're going to do some analysis of what's going on right now. Where does Turkey fit into this picture, especially Turkey's relationship with the Kurds?
Turkey has a very large Kurdish population. They have never gotten along well. The Turkish state has always considered Kurdish nationalism to be a threat. The state fears that Turkey could become the next Yugoslavia or next Soviet Union and split apart.
Well, there is the PKK, which is Kurdish-associated inside Turkey, which both Turkey and the U.S. recognize as a terrorist organization, correct?
That's true. And the PKK is also embraced by large numbers of Kurds inside of Turkey as their only representative because legal Kurdish identity or cultural organizations don't exist. So therefore, the PKK has more or less a monopoly on large amounts of Turkish sympathies, Kurdish sympathies in Turkey. So because the Turkish state considers Kurdish authority and power to be a threat, it not only has repressed Kurdish mayors and Kurdish political movements inside its own country, it wants to be sure that there is no Kurdish presence inside Syria along the Turkish border. This has, I think, two benefits for President Erdogan at this moment. Number one, it gives him a step in his dream of reestablishing some kind of larger Turkey or Ottoman authority in a region where the countries that used to dominate, like Egypt and Iran and Iraq, no longer have any political power. And it also helps Erdogan at home. It's always good in Turkey when there's an economic or political uncertainty to gin up the anti-Kurdish nationalist feeling. And this has already had a positive effect. It helps Erdogan at home while it feeds his fantasies of Ottoman power abroad.
Okay, so now we're going to move to some of the analysis of what's happening right now. And I want to do this kind of rapid fire. All right, so question number one, regardless of whether you agree with the United States pulling out of Syria, are the criticisms that it destabilizes our relationships with other countries because it looks like we will turn and betray, are those fair and is that risky for the U.S.?
Those are fair. It certainly was a betrayal, but we have been betraying the Kurds over history. You can write a book about it, and in fact, people have. The idea that the U.S. is always a steadfast and faithful ally was never really justified. And if anyone should know this, it's the Kurds, who have been repeatedly betrayed after following U.S. promises time and again.
So what about those who are crying foul and saying other allies now won't trust us? I think you're saying other allies never should have trusted us. Is that really what you're saying?
I think that when you get into treaty allies with whom we have permanent alliances, yes, I think there is a measure of trust demanded. But when it comes to these alliances out in other parts of the world, we should never think that the militias that we ally with don't have their own interests. And we have our own interests. Ultimately, in the end, those interests are going to separate. And it's naive for anybody to believe that a country like the United States will have permanent allies rather than just permanent interests.
Okay, so let's put another piece of the puzzle in place. The other country from that general region that we've been hearing a lot about is Ukraine. Does it fit into this picture? And if so, how?
I think it's distantly related, and I think the relation would have to be through Russia. Russia is insisting that it has a right to help shape geopolitical events in its neighborhood. And actually, Ukraine will always be closer to Russia than it is to us, and so will Syria. So I think we need to step back from this idea that everything that's geopolitically good for Russia is bad for us. Everything that's good for Assad is bad for us. This isn't true. In fact, the greatest benefit for the United States, the best policy for us in the long run in Syria to tamp down extremism in that region would be to promote unification of Syria under the present government. We've never been able to do that because we want to overthrow the present government. But it's now time for us to swallow and realize that the Kurds are doing something that can promote stability, which is that ultimate goal of unifying Syria under the authority of the central government.
Okay, so I have to acknowledge that there are some listeners whose hair you're curling now with some of what you're saying, but it's helpful to get a perspective on this and get it combed out. There's one other strategic issue I want to bring in. Here is a quick cut of something the president said yesterday while discussing the agreement.
We've secured the oil, and therefore a small number of U.S. troops will remain in the area where they have the oil. And we're going to be protecting it, and we'll be deciding what we're going to do with it in the future.
It is not typical to hear us so openly talking about financial and other kinds of economic and strategic interests when discussing policy in the Middle East. What do you make of the very overt way the president is choosing to talk about the role of oil in this agreement and in this region?
I like it way better than when Donald Rumsfeld said, quote, about the Iraq War, "This war has nothing to do with oil, literally nothing to do with oil." I like Trump's formulation better.
Why?
Because it's more honest. Nobody, no great power has ever made policies toward the Middle East in the 20th or 21st century that are not related to oil. So let's put it right out there.
Okay, so that then makes me want to ask from my old poli-sci classes, right? Are we, okay, backtrack. No one's talked about whether or not any of this is internationally illegal except you. You said one thing about that here. Are we in a realm now of just pure real politics, practical policy, where international law norms and the global order just don't matter anymore?
One reason unification of Syria is so important is that under a united government, only the foreign forces invited by the government are allowed in the country. The U.S. forces in Afghanistan and the U.S. forces in Saudi Arabia and the U.S. forces in Iraq are there legally because they have been invited by the governments of those countries. Our troops in Syria are not there legally. They have no authority either from the United States or any international authority. So the idea that we would rampage in and seize the oil of another country violates the basic principle of the UN, which is what they call the inadmissibility of the acquisition of territory by force.
Okay, 30 seconds. What is the single thing that you think people should be looking for or paying attention to most?
Let's try to promote projects that unify Syria. And if the Kurds want to unify with the central government of Syria and anyone else wants to do that, that's good for promoting an end to the war and the prospect of a secular Syria making political progress over the next generation.
Stephen Kinzer, Senior Fellow in International and Public Affairs at Brown University's Wanson Institute, also author of the book Poisoner in Chief, Sidney Gottlieb and the CIA Search for Mind Control. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Tiziana Dearing. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Dearing. Across New England, students and families are looking at colleges, and they're facing a new worry. Will the school where I enroll even exist by the time my child graduates? This is spurred by a series of small college closures. Mount Ida College abruptly closed last year, then Newberry College in Brookline, followed by three schools in Vermont. So how should we be thinking about this new landscape? All this week, WBUR has been taking a closer look at the challenges facing small nonprofit schools as part of a series called Small Colleges, Big Challenges. Here to discuss is Michael Horn. He's the co-founder of the Clayton Christensen Institute, a nonprofit think tank, and his new book is called Choosing College: How to Make Better Learning Decisions Throughout Your Life. Michael, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Also with us on the line is Casey Neer. She's the Newton-based executive director of counseling at CollegeWise, a college counseling company. Casey, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And you, call us. Do you have children looking at colleges? Are you worried about the stability of small schools in the region? Or do you work for a small school or do business with one and it's on your mind? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. Okay, Michael, first, you study the business of higher education. Why are these closures happening?
Yeah, so fundamentally, these business models that underlie small schools are breaking at the seams. We have costs increasing year over year over year, driven by administrative costs, services that they're providing going up, and just basic salary adjustments constantly increasing. And at the same time, you have families that just can't keep up with these revenue increases. We see tuitions going up year over year over year, but what people don't know is that the discount rate, meaning what people actually pay, is not going up nearly as fast. So colleges are not actually bringing in nearly as much revenue. And the costs are just exceeding the revenue. And it's putting these budgets at stress. On top of that, in New England in particular, we're just starting to enter a demographic cliff where there's going to be far fewer high school graduates in the years ahead, which is just putting a lot of stress. Fewer students, inability to pay the costs that underlie these schools. And that's a recipe for disaster.
Okay, so my heart is racing, even just listening to you lay it out that way. Now, there is so much that goes into choosing a school. You interviewed a lot of students, a lot of parents for this new book. I got to believe that actually this hasn't even factored in, but maybe I'm wrong. Is factoring in the school's short-term viability even part of most people's process?
You're 100% correct. We talked to well over 200 students in making this book, creating essentially mini documentaries of their choice. And no one mentioned this. Literally zero students mentioned it. I think it's starting to change slightly among parents. Hampshire College in particular, when they announced that they were looking for a merger last year, I think that just sort of went on people's radar. You know, they had heard of Mount Ida, they had heard of Newberry, but Hampshire has this sort of iconic status in the New England landscape. And I think that started to get some parents' attention. So my sense is that's starting to change, but not really still. It's not really what students are looking at when they're thinking about getting into school.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. If you'd like to join the conversation, Casey, I got to believe you hear all kinds of anxiety from the families you counsel. It's an anxious process. Is this one of the items on the list for them?
I mean, I agree. I think listening to all of that had my heart racing. And I deal, you know, pretty much 24/7 in parent and teen anxiety, which is already through the roof with standardized testing and pretty much everything else. I think, you know, the short answer is frankly no. I think agreed that there are probably not as much focus on some of these, you know, the fiscal stability of some of these places. But I also think that a lot of anxiety oftentimes in this process comes from this notion of scarcity, that, you know, there's not enough options. There's not enough spots to go around, whether we're talking about highly selective schools or places that might be potentially closing. And the reality is, in my view, this is still a consumer or student, you know, landscape in the sense that there are still over 2,300 schools. And I do think that it's important for families to recognize that it would be bad counseling for me to tell a family, great, apply to one college. Maybe it'll close in 6 months. That's not a good idea. I think any kid needs to be applying to a broad range of colleges and then comparing a broad range of acceptance letters and financial aid packages and discount rates and all of the things, then making an astute decision. I don't want families thinking, oh my gosh, what if my kid gets into one school and that school closes? We can avoid that. That's a solvable problem.
Is there anything
there are big problems?
Yeah. Is there anything about the way that you advise families that has changed since first Mount Ida, then Newberry College, then Hampshire is on thin ice, et cetera?
In the day-to-day, frankly, not yet and not really. I think the reality is that that is one of the factors that students should be considering when looking and making final decisions of, is this a place that I can thrive and kind of, you know, succeed in? And if it's a place that's not aligned and doesn't feel like it's a good match on a lot of levels, then I'm not going to counsel a kid to go there. But I don't think that it's come up, frankly, and I don't know that it changes the way in which most kids are going to engage with this process in the short term.
Michael, Casey talked about a good match there, and there is this sense that these small nonprofit universities in the New England region are of a certain type, and that that certain type is both storied and valued. So what gets lost as an option for families when these types of institutions face financial threat?
Yeah, what's so interesting about this that a lot of reporters love to push me on is that this small private college closure crisis really only affects roughly 5% of students that go to college. Most students go to public institutions that are significantly larger, or community colleges and the like. It's a minority of students that go to these smaller schools. But I think what that misses is exactly what you're pointing to, which is that this is an option that is very distinct from those large public schools where you can get lost in a sea of faces. And people like that picturesque experience. They like that personalization, getting to know your faculty members and professors and other students around the campus in a small, intimate environment. And I think one of the challenges facing American higher education right now is that a lot of institutions are in a race to all look the same. And actually, the strength of American higher education historically has been the diversity of choices that we have. And so losing these options, I think, in the landscape, it definitely loses something. It loses an option that is important for parents and students to be exploring.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Are you worried about us losing a type of college in our landscape with the closing of these small bucolic nonprofit colleges in New England? Do you think the system's broken? Is the model broken? Are you looking for something different as you think ahead to your kids, or maybe you have kids in the higher education system now? Casey, the state legislature is considering a bill that would make colleges have to disclose certain financial information in an effort to create more transparency. I would think, you know, supporting discerning families, that's attractive. But some are pushing back, saying, hey, you make us do that, you may cause a rapid withdrawal of students and investments that will force us over a tipping point to close. How do you, as a voter but also a professional, think about legislation like that, and what do you think the right balance is?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a fair question, and I think part of it comes back to this notion that I think colleges and people aren't often aware of this. When I worked in admissions, and I think there's a lot more transparency now with recent coverage of how many stakeholders there are in an institution, the amount of people that have a say, for better or for worse, in the class of students that ends up getting admitted, the amount of stakeholders at play. There is a lot of, I think, both transparency and people in the room to try and make sure that college is sustainable. I would actually flip this, and I actually think what needs a lot more regulation is the for-profit college industry. And I know that's not what necessarily we're talking about, but that's an area where I see the kids who are most affected by these closures, which are low-income students, Pell Grant recipients that are then pushed into for-profit institutions, and then lenders. I think those are two areas that need a lot more regulation. I don't know that I would push as hard at the nonprofit schools that we're talking about that are accredited and go through a lot of transparency already.
Michael, let me just ask you for your reactions to that. I noticed at one point you actually even chuckled, so let me just let you pick it up for a
minute. I guess the big thing, I agree. I think in terms of, fundamentally this mindset among students has to shift to not just trying to get into a school, but actually choosing the right fit. I guess the pushback I would have is I think more transparency for students to make an informed choice at the end of the day is a really good thing, and we should remember that the entities that authorize and govern our institutions of higher education, their purpose is to serve the students, not the institution. And so giving that more information, I think, is important. And I would push back a little bit on just regulating the for-profits. I think that's important. But the for-profit sector has been shrinking quite a bit over the last decade. I think we ought to look at all institutions equally and make sure that there's enough information so that students can make smart decisions for their circumstance.
All right, I have to go back because I'm distracted by this question that just keeps playing in my head as I hear the two of you speak. And Casey, I think something you said launched it for me. You both are so calm and relaxed about this whole situation, about the availability of schools for people, et cetera. And yet families, as they're going through this process, live in this psychotic pressure cooker world that suggests that you're never going to get in anywhere. Your child's never going to be able to afford a house, and that one might be true, and that you have to jump through 17 hoops, and it's incredibly scarce, and a closing of a college is going to end the future of some certain percentage of young people. I don't hear either of you saying any of that, so what's the deal? Where's the disconnect there? Casey, maybe you first.
Oh, gosh, yes. Where to begin? I mean, I think, like I said at the beginning, I do think that understandably our brains are attuned to outliers. We love it every year in our counseling profession to wait for the inevitable, story about the kid who brokered peace between two nations and saved, a kitten from a tree and had a perfect GPA and they didn't get into Harvard, right? And the end of the story is always, and they have to go to Duke. and this notion that even these kids can't get in, right? And the reality is the vast majority of kids, they can go to college. There are plenty of issues in terms of access to higher ed for low-income students, but the median acceptance rate for college these days hovers around 68%. The vast majority of colleges admit the vast majority of their applicants. That's not a story we talk about. But if you want to go to college, you can. Now, if you want to pay and retain, we have actual problems. But if we're talking about access to higher ed in terms of getting in, that's not actually a story. I think we fixate on it because it's scintillating, but it's not actually a problem. There are plenty of other problems.
So, Michael, does that mean that the financial model for most institutions is also still working?
So first, I totally agree with Casey, just to make the point that we've told this story around scarcity, and there's really only under 100 institutions that are truly scarce in terms of that they are very highly selective and they limit who they enroll. Even those writ large are arguably easier to get into today. Not maybe the one school, but one of the schools. It's never been easier. In terms of the financial models, I think those elite schools, they're on sound footing. I think the large public flagship universities, they're on sound footing as well.
Give an example. Just is that
so
like
the Ohio State, okay. UMass Amherst, they're fine, right? But I actually think if you start looking at small regional colleges, for example, if you go into Pennsylvania and look at their small regional colleges that are in Harrisburg and regions like that, they're actually at threat as well. And so it's sort of if you look outside those top 200, top 300 schools, there are a lot of institutions right now that are at peril of collapse. It's not just the small private liberal arts schools, although those are certainly driving the headlines right now. But if you look at religious schools, for-profit schools, and so forth, there's a lot of consolidation going on.
All right, let's take a call. David from Framingham is on the line. David, you're welcome to join the conversation.
Thank you. So there's a couple points that I'd like to make. One is the absence of governance in these boards, where if there is a financial viability issue, that it's clear that either they're not equipped or they're often poorly able to communicate that message and take the appropriate action. The second piece is, as someone who's interacted with the educational system in Europe, in Australia, as well as the United States, I do see an overabundance of small colleges here relative to other developed countries, which is surprising considering the market dynamics here. So I'm
curious, David, why are you surprised?
Well, given the fact that so much of our infrastructure is focused on, you know, channeling students to basically the highest ranking schools, right?
Got it.
The rankings matter a lot in the United States. It's surprising that these schools have been in business over the last 20 years to begin with.
Okay, so let me pick it up from you there, David, and give our guests an opportunity to respond to what you've said. Michael, what's your response for David's
point? Yeah, so I think the board's point is a huge point, that a lot of boards have not been active enough to ask the difficult questions much earlier than before a school goes into crisis mode. And they have to get way more educated about this. It's one of the reasons I think that regulation from the state could help, because it could be an early warning sign to the institution and the board members that actually we have a larger problem here. We have some concerns looking at your financial sustainability. And before we alert students, let's actually have a conversation among the board members and the State Department of Higher Education, and then figure out a go-forward path. In terms of the disproportionate number of private institutions in the United States, it's actually more acute in New England. If you go out to the western part of the country, Arizona, California, and so forth, there's actually many more public institutions than there are privates, relatively speaking. And so I think it's a fair characterization or way to think about it that maybe the closures we're seeing is sort of the New England coming into line with the rest of the country, let alone the rest of the world. That's an interesting read of it. I think that's fair.
Okay. Earlier today, we spoke with Rodolfo Aguilar. He's a parent and an organizer with Massachusetts Parent United. He's got one kid in college and two that are going to start looking at schools soon. And he told us that he's actually recently started trying to look into the financial health of prospective colleges. Here he is.
Before, I was not thinking in how the financially this institution was doing. Today, I have to make sure that my kids are going to go to a school, that in the process, that the school is not going to close and put them in a disadvantage. I don't want to put that burden or that anxiety on my kids' education.
So, Casey, no parent obviously would want that burden or anxiety for their kid. If a parent that you were advising said, give me a couple of things I can do to kind of assess the health of the institutions my kids are applying to, or maybe my kid got in somewhere, I want to make sure they're solid, what's something you might advise?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very fair and understandable concern. I think one piece is that I think one is recognizing that oftentimes the fiscal viability, and there's always Moody's ratings and credit scores, and those often aren't always a tell. I think one thing I always look for is, what's the retention rate? How many students are actually graduating? They are required to release their six-year graduation rate percentage.
Where would a parent find that, Casey?
They can find that on Big Future, which is part of College Board. They also have common data set, which is something they all have to release. You can also just Google, you know, Northeastern six-year graduation rate or Northeastern retention rate. One thing I would caution is that oftentimes retention rates are lower for schools unfortunately so, who have a high percentage of Pell Grant recipients, of low-income students, because they stop in and start in to pay for college. But that is one way to go. Is this a school that's not just admitting students, but actually graduating them? That's an incredibly important statistic to know.
Okay, Michael, in our last minute, is this the beginning of a kind of a much larger disruption in the four-year college model?
I think it is. I think we're going to see a lot of these closures closures happening across the Midwest as well, Ohio, Michigan, and so forth. And we also have, we haven't talked about it, but there's this other force of online learning coming in. I don't think it's going to replace the brick-and-mortar campus experience by any means, but I do think that it will start to pair itself with brick-and-mortar campuses in innovative ways that'll create lower-cost options. Think of Warby Parker instead of Macy's.
Warby Parker being the glasses manufacturer.
The glasses manufacturer, and they've got retail all around Boston now, and they're very small footprints, and they let you try it on, let you socialize with the employees, but they don't carry the huge inventory in these huge opulent campuses. I think we'll see something similar.
Michael Horn, co-founder of the Clayton Christensen Institute, a nonprofit think tank. His new book is called Choosing College, How to Make Better Learning Decisions Throughout Your Life. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Casey Neer, a Newton-based executive director of counseling at CollegeWise, a college counseling company. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Stay with us. There's more coming up. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering.
Hey, Reddit Food. This is Oliver Babish. I am a filmmaker, wannabe chef, and like you, I've always wondered, what does the food in film and television actually taste like? I'm here to answer some of those questions today. Today, we're making Chris Traeger's...
This is a clip from the popular YouTube channel Binging with Babish. It's created by filmmaker and home cook Andrew Ray, where he brings to life the food that appears in popular movies and television shows, like Krabby Patties from SpongeBob or Pigeon Pie from The Game of Thrones. Binging with Babish now has more than 5.45 million subscribers and over 240 videos. They're awesome. I've watched some of them.
Thank you so much.
Yep. And a cookbook, Binging with Babish, 100 recipes created from your favorite movies and TV shows. In Studio 3 with me now, Andrew Ray. Hello.
Thank you so much for having me.
And listeners, we're streaming live on Facebook because we know you're wondering what Andrew looks like. You can find us on the Radio Boston Facebook page. All right, so I have to get my geek on for just a second. Babish is a reference to Oliver Babish. You said that up front.
Absolutely.
My all-time favorite West Wing character.
Really?
Yes. How did you wind up naming yourself after Oliver Babish?
I thought it was funny. I named my Reddit username, my Reddit handle, Oliver Babish, because I thought it was funny. And then I named the show Binging with Babish because I didn't know what else to call it, and I didn't expect it to go anywhere. And now here we are.
Yeah, so. He was a completely unlikable lawyer.
I liked him.
I loved him, as you know.
He has one of the best lines in the whole show. He was like, Mrs. Bartlett, in my entire life, I've never found anything charming. And it's like the meanest and most like, it was so cool. And I actually have a tattoo right here. This is his, as he called it, the gavel given to his grandfather by Justice Brandeis, I think it was.
Yes.
Everybody called it his big hammer.
That's
and now
awesome.
I have a tattoo of it.
Awesome. All right. So we should back up, though, and you should tell us about your first experiences in the kitchen, because you cook now. So tell us about that.
My earliest experiences in the kitchen, my mother taught me to cook when I was very young, you know, things like Nestle Toll House cookies and some soups and simple things. She passed away when I was 11. So it was a very nice way to, you know, feel closer to her and remember her through cooking. Sometimes you can leave a very important legacy in that way when you cook for others. So
you talk in the introduction of this book about trying some pretty ambitious stuff without really the chops to pull it off. And at some point, you kind of became more self-aware and said, hey, how about I just make stuff that tastes good?
Yeah, exactly. I think that that's a pitfall that a lot of newcomers to the kitchen are victim to, is thinking, you know, I should try and make the most impressive dishes, these really experimental and beautiful things, when in fact the thing that I'm consistently most impressed by and enjoy the most, and I think everybody else would agree with me, is that when you go to a friend's house for dinner and they make the best damn burger you've ever had in your life, instead of, you know, a conceptually frustrating 12-course tasting menu, I'd much rather have the former. And it took me a long time to learn that. And I was trying to cook well above my pay grade, as I call it, for a long time. And I try to encourage people to really just master the basics. That's really what, yeah.
Now, once you went back to the basics, did you find over time, though, now you could cook the fancy pants 12 course if you wanted to? Have you developed those more complex skills?
Yeah. With mastering the basics, it comes an understanding of why food behaves the way it does. And, once you understand, you know, if I apply heat to this, high heat, it's going to act this way. As soon as you grasp those absolute basics of food behavior, then you can start diving into those more complex things, which would probably overwhelm you if it were your first time, or it just wouldn't come out correctly. Some people can do it.
and good for them.
God love
but
them.
Most of us, I think you should really just try to make the best grilled cheese you've ever had. Make the best pasta you've ever had. Get that out of the way first and make that for your friends. They'll thank you for it.
Okay, so we have two dishes in front of you. One of them is not the best pasta you've ever had. And we will come back to that one in a minute.
Some weird smells in here.
But the other one is the Traeger Turkey Burger, which was the accidental genesis for your cooking career on YouTube. And the name hints at it, but it was inspired by a character on Parks and Rec, Chris Traeger, the health nut. He's marathon runner, overly sort of positive boss character played by Rob Lowe.
Mm-hmm. I humbly place before you my East Meets West patented Traeger Turkey Burger, an Asian fusion burger made with Willow Farms organic turkey, a toasted Taleggio cheese crisp, papaya chutney, black truffle aioli, and microgreens on a gluten-free brioche bun. Enjoy.
This tastes as delicious as Beyonce smells. I'm guessing.
What is this in here? Saffron?
Wow, somebody's got a sharp palate.
So I don't even like him just listening to that. But the burger, so take us back. You're watching this on TV. You're in your kitchen. What happens?
Well, I'm a big background watcher. I put on things that I enjoy. I'm a huge rewatcher, too. I had seen that episode like five times, as long with every other episode of Parks, because it's one of my favorite shows. So I put it on like it's music. I think of TV shows in particular. I would never watch one just once. You know, I've never listened to a song just once. So I put it on in the background, and I was setting up a camera in my kitchen because I wanted to try to get into food photography, and that scene came on. I was like, huh, what would that burger actually taste like? And I was like, I should probably make that, which was a challenge.
It's actually pretty complicated.
Yeah, it's actually, you know, I tried to do everything from scratch. I figured that's what Chris would do. He's a very healthy guy, so you know, most of the ingredients here make sense. The only thing that didn't really make sense was Taleggio cheese crisp, because Taleggio is very soft cheese. I don't really think you'd make a crisp out of it. I might be wrong, but I went with Parmesan instead just because it's something that crisps up really nicely. You guys did a great job. These look great.
Well, so Zoe, one of our producers, actually made this burger. She wasn't able to find the microgreens, which I understand neither could you. When you first tried to do this, is that right? You struggled to find them?
It was hard to find them, but I did eventually find them. The hardest thing to find was the gluten-free brioche bun.
I don't think these are gluten-free buns. Zoe says no, they're not.
I'm sorry, this won't do.
No,
I'm kidding. No, it's great. It looks beautiful.
Let's try it. Let's both try
Absolutely.
It. We'll both have a bite.
Here, I'll grab a half here. Right. Oh, they're warm, too. How'd you do this?
Well, Zoe's a master. That's how we did it.
I'm going to get crumbs
it's
everywhere.
Zoe.
Is that okay?
Yeah, that's all good.
Okay. Well, there's a lot of papaya chutney on this.
That's really
that's
good.
Yeah.
Silence on the radio while we both chew.
Do you normally do radio with full mouths?
No, but I drink on the radio when I can,
oh,
so I figure
fun.
Why not eat too?
Can we do that? No? Okay.
This is delicious, and I have a bone to pick with you because you totally diss turkey burgers when you talk about this burger. This is really good, and I like turkey burgers.
It is very good. I was very surprised by how good it is, but it is not as good as a beef burger. It's just not possible for a turkey burger to
That is a pretty sweeping statement to make, that there is no turkey burger in the world that can be as good as
Let's face this. This is good. Let's face it. This is good because it's dressed up. The beef burger on its own tastes good.
Yeah, I have to admit it's all the extra stuff on here.
Exactly.
Blacks, truffle aioli.
Actually, I have another bite.
Yeah, go for it. You work on that, and I'll frame up another question for you and give you a second to chew. Because swear to God, this is really good. Like, I'm going to eat the rest of this for dinner when the show is over. Okay. Now, one of the things that's really striking about the book is, I know I took the plate. People can see this. And I took the plate and I left him with no plate to put his burger
on.
That's fine.
Only one of us could end up with it.
Sorry about that. You know, you get into the front of this book. This is a very personal cookbook. I don't expect to learn about somebody's life journey, their struggle with depression, their divorce, even a description of all their tattoos and where they come from. Why did you want to include this kind of intimacy in this book?
Well, the show is a very... it's an extension of myself. It's the way that I've found to express myself, and it's become my creative outlet, and it was the thing that pulled me out of depression. And it's part of its story and its history. I wanted to share that because a lot of people who've watched the show, from what I've read on Instagram, what I've read on Reddit and in the comments, they've, you know, taken up cooking sometimes because they've watched the show and they're like, oh, I think I want to try that. And they found a new hobby, or they've made something for their spouse or whatever, something lovely. And sometimes they're going through ruts too. And I want people to know that I was in a really dark, terrible place when I came up with the show and when I started making the show. And it can get better. You can pull yourself out of this situation. You have to help yourself, and you need to, you know, take a risk on yourself and try to find something that I call it the flow. I don't call it the flow state, but, you know, puts you in the flow state, the where everything else melts away and all that exists is what you're focusing on. I'm going down a tangent here, but
that's all right. I asked.
The point is that you know, this show is born of darkness in some ways. And I just want to show, in the same way that I show my mistakes on the show, when I screw something up for a dish, I always show it.
Yeah, one time when you were making these, I think it was on like Vice, you forgot to put the eggplant in.
Yeah, and I insisted that they leave that in because I was
wondered about that.
Yeah, no, I wanted them to leave that in because I like to show my mistakes because mistakes can be learning opportunities. And same thing with life. That's why I included the personal mistakes that I've made in the past and how I've tried to turn those into opportunities.
So when did you know that you were kind of on fire with this? That you were, I mean, it couldn't have been from the first YouTube video. When did you really know you were doing something that was so special to other people?
The channel's first windfall was when I did the Moist Maker from Friends. It's a Thanksgiving leftover sandwich with a slice of gravy-soaked bread in the center, which is a brilliant innovation. And it was the first one to sort of get picked up by Reddit. It climbed Reddit videos, which is kind of a barometer for how popular something will become on the internet in some ways. It was picked up by Entertainment Weekly and whatever. And that's when I knew, okay, I have something that people want to see here. It's just about getting it in front of the right eyes. And I committed to making an episode every week, and I haven't missed a week since. I did miss one week because I had the flu last year. But
I think that's acceptable. All right. But not every dish you make is something people want to eat or want to see.
Nope.
So let's talk about Elf spaghetti.
Oh,
okay. There are a few recipes. They're a little more fun. There is one from the Christmas movie Elf.
Yeah, that's probably the worst recipe that I left in the book. I left out some of the really repugnant ones, like Charlie's milk steak from It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, which is a steak boiled in milk topped with jelly beans. You don't need a recipe for that. But if for some reason you want to make this, I wanted to at least include it. It's a standalone episode. It's a popular episode. And what it is pasta that's been covered with sort of, you know, gas station sweets. You know, you got M&M's, you got chocolate chips. You got crumbled up Pop-Tarts. You got chocolate syrup, maple syrup.
And there is a photo of this concoction on our website, listeners, so you can picture it if you're not watching on Facebook. All right,
yeah.
So let's do this. We got to eat it.
I
boiled the pasta last night. Did not use your fabulous suggestions of butter and olive oil in the pan afterward, which now I'm kicking myself for.
I don't think it's going to improve this, honestly.
But while you and I chew, let's listen to Buddy talk about this this pasta. And really,
sounds
you
good.
First.
Okay, thank you.
Can you pass the maple syrup, please?
I didn't put it. It's spaghetti.
You know what? I think I have something.
You like sugar, huh?
Is there sugar in syrup?
Yes.
Then yes!
Okay, he did it. I have to say, with a big wad of chocolate chips right through, and there is tomato sauce on this pasta. I'm going for the M&Ms and the pasta and the chocolate, and I'm killing time for Andrew so he can finish chewing. Now, while I eat this monstrosity,
air,
you
yeah.
say something about it.
Well, let's talk about the notes that we're picking up here. No, I mean, the bite that I just had, I think, was primarily chocolate chips, so I got off easy. But that amount of sugar, and cheap sugar, too, it's like, you know, cheap sweets, does not work with a spongy kind of texture of that pasta has. If you got any tomato sauce there, it definitely doesn't work with that. So I also regret that this is one of the few recipes that I didn't try to
improve.
Yeah, and try to make a good version of. That's what I try to do with any bad recipe. I try to make the Babish version, which is like something halfway edible at least. And I didn't do it with this one. And I'm hoping to revisit it again soon so I can do that. What do you think of it?
Well, okay, so here's the truth. When you first just get hit with the chocolate, we're all good. It's just melty chocolate.
To be sure.
And then all of a sudden your taste buds are like, wait, what?
Yeah.
And when you get to that point, it just all, you know.
The texture and flavor doesn't make sense. It's like eating an orange and it tastes like an apple or something.
No, that's much better than how this tastes.
No, that would actually be cool. Never mind. Bad example.
All right, we have about a half a minute left. So what is next for you?
Well, I'm on tour right now. I'm here in Boston tonight at the Wilbur Theater. You can come check it out. It's going to be a Q&A. It's going to be a lovely book signing.
We have information on tickets on RadioBoston.org.
Very cool. Thank you. Bigger picture stuff, I'm going to be working on opening a brew pub in Brooklyn where you can come watch me make the show. You can have a beer. You can expect that to hopefully be open mid-2020. That's the hope.
I hope we'll hear from you while you open that place. That'd be great to have you back.
Thank you so much.
All right. That's Andrew Ray. He's a filmmaker and chef behind the popular YouTube cooking channel Binging with Babish. He has a new cookbook out and will, as he said, be appearing at the Wilbur tonight.
Thanks so much for having me.
That is our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Zoe Mitchell, who is also a fabulous cook, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, Jamie Bologna, and Walter Wuthman. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.